What is up, Vermont Edition podcast listener? This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for VPR. Just to let you know, this podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinsel. For new members of the legislature, the 2021 session had to have been a very unusual experience. Instead of meeting in person with other lawmakers and constituents, members held all of their floor discussions, committee meetings, and votes by video. And in some cases, new lawmakers never met some of their new colleagues. It was also the first session for Vermont's new Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray. On many days, Gray could be seen conducting the business of the Senate from the podium in the Senate chamber, surrounded by video screens to help her monitor the flow of legislation through that chamber. Well, what have the last 6 months been like for Molly Gray? What are some of her top priorities moving forward? Those are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray. Lieutenant Governor, welcome to Vermont Edition. Great to have you on the program.
Hi, Bob. It's great to be on. Thanks so much for having me.
Let's just start off with how unusual this session was. And I'm wondering what it was like for you as someone who had not been part of the State House before January of 2021. There you were doing remote work as the presiding officer of the Senate. How hard was this for you?
Oh, well, you know, there's no playbook for presiding over the Senate during a pandemic. And in some ways, Bob, there was no bad habits to unlearn, right? So coming into this incredible new position, so deeply, deeply grateful to be elected, to be serving as lieutenant governor. The day before my swearing in was the insurrection in Washington, right? And so this building that is traditionally open, and I'm in the State House today, I'm actually sitting down in Senate Finance because the building's open and people are coming in, and it's so wonderful. But on January 7th, the building was completely shut down, not only because of COVID, but because of what had happened in Washington and security concerns right here in Vermont, right here in Montpelier and around the State House. So that was pretty unprecedented. And then to start the session, you know, each day in the building coming in, it was closed. There weren't any people in the building. The pro tem was here some days and the speaker and obviously the staff and security, but going up to the Senate chamber, grabbing the gavel, gaveling in, and then looking for all the senators on a big screen is pretty unique. But we got through it. The Senate did an incredible amount of work. My hat goes off to them. I think it's a real testament to Vermont, Vermont's endurance, Vermont's commitment to democracy that the legislature was able to do as much as it was able to do. And deeply proud to be in the building and making sure what happened, happened.
What do you think your biggest takeaway is from the 2021 session? What did you learn during this session that you didn't know before?
I think one of the biggest things that I feel proud of is that we see the legislature, we see the governor, we see our congressional delegation all coming together to put Vermonters at the forefront. I think I'd like to say very often that we're all on Team Vermont, right? Whether we're progressives or Republicans or, you know, Democrats. We've focused on vaccinations. We've focused on COVID relief, getting an initial COVID relief funding out the door. And now the big question is how to spend the American Rescue Plan money. But I think there are a lot of critical investments, be it broadband or childcare, our state colleges and workforce development, things that I see as deeply critical to the future of our state, to some of our demographic challenges and crises, which is why I ran for office. I see those investments happening, and they're happening in a way that is nonpartisan and all of us coming together. So I'm really proud of that. And I think it's not a surprise by any means, because I think that's what we do here in Vermont, but it's just wonderful to see it happening in reality.
You mentioned the beginning of this session being the State House being closed, not only because of COVID, but because of the attack on the Capitol building in Washington on January 6th. As you look around the Vermont State House, and it's open this week for the first time in 15 months, which is a really great thing, what is your feeling about security at the State House? Do you think additional steps need to be put into place, or are things pretty much okay the way they are?
I think things are okay the way they are. I think to see people, to see people, I was just walking down the hall to come into this committee room to do the call, and just to see people walking around, to see kids, to see people visiting Vermont, just soaking up some of our history and having the building open, that's our Vermont way. And I don't think security is going to address sort of the bigger question or bigger challenge, which is how do Vermonters feel about government, or how do Americans feel about government? One thing that I feel really proud of is what we did after the insurrection in Washington, and something that I campaigned on over the last year is just getting young people involved in government, getting them involved in civic engagement, making sure that government feels really accessible and open. So we did this thing called Lieutenant Governor for a Day, where we had classrooms and students zooming into the State House and then virtually kind of coming up to the Senate chamber. We'd all gavel in together. So they just had a sense of what was going on here, even when the doors were closed, even when the building was closed. And I think it was President Biden, during one of his addresses over the last few months, said to Congress, he said, you know, oftentimes we think about government, and we think about government being something separate or different or far away. But in fact, government is we the people. And I think that's so true in Vermont in particular. So I think it's good that the building's open. I think that we have enough security. I think our challenge, or our opportunity rather, is to get as many young people in the state excited about service, and service in all the forms that it can take in our communities and across the state.
Lieutenant Governor, one of the things that you highlighted during this session was inequity in public health, an issue that a lot of people felt really took on heightened importance during the COVID pandemic. What are some of the efforts that were launched during the pandemic to reduce some of the existing inequities, and how far are we from really dealing with this problem in a practical way?
I think the pandemic, as we all know, exposed so many of our vulnerabilities as a state. And I share this story with a lot of compassion and understanding, but also with, wait a second, how do we get there? And the story is this. Last July, I think it was, when the pandemic was really picking up and there was a lot of information going out across the state on public safety and public health, we didn't have the tools, as I understand it, to translate a lot of that information into the languages of our former refugees, right? We have dozens of languages, different languages spoken here in the state. And so that creates a lot of inequity, right? If Vermonters don't know how to take safety measures during a pandemic, and Vermonters aren't able to go into a health center and have someone there who has the cultural literacy or cultural competency to understand cultural changes and access to health care, maybe that looks different, right, for some people, to making sure people feel comfortable. So if we're going to be a state, which I think we should be, that welcomes former refugees, that is truly inclusive, that allows for diversity and real success, we need to make those investments. So what have some of those investments been? The multilingual task force, right, to address some of these translation challenges. In Burlington, I think one of the biggest success stories from the pandemic comes from a clinic that was set up by AALV, by the Association of Africans Living in Vermont, by the Racial Justice Alliance, by the Vermont Professionals of Colors Network, and our Vermont National Guard, that were every Saturday running a clinic in downtown Burlington. They had cultural brokers there. It was just, I was able to stop by during the spring, and it was festive, it was engaging, it was culturally appropriate. And I think part of our high vaccination rate in the state is because of those sorts of collaborations. So a lot of success stories, but a lot of work that still needs to be done. And one reason I think we had the second gentleman of the United States come to Vermont is because they know that we've done such a good job, and especially reaching Vermonters from different backgrounds that really need our support. So a lot to be proud of, but a lot of good work to do still.
I was wondering, given the inequities in the healthcare system that you've outlined, do you support the legislation to provide primary healthcare coverage for all Vermonters?
I do think it's the direction that we need to go. We need to have accessible, quality healthcare across Vermont. But I think it's not a one investment solves the problem. What I know from the Recover Stronger Tour, again, I don't know if I told you about this, but we started just 2 weeks ago spending one day per week in a different county in the state, meeting Vermonters directly where they're at and listening, because there's so much we do not know from this pandemic. How has it impacted our healthcare system? How has it impacted access to broadband? What that means now for Vermont. But one thing I learned about recently from the Rutland Regional Medical Center and all the providers there is that telehealth is absolutely critical moving forward. It can't just be a pandemic response. It has to be something that we allow Vermonters to access, be it for primary care, for certain appointments, or for ongoing care moving forward. So I think there are a lot of lessons learned, and access, universal access to primary care is a piece of that, but there are a lot of other pieces, and we have a real opportunity. We have a real opportunity to align our budget with our greatest needs, and particularly when it comes to healthcare.
Because advocates of the primary health care coverage proposal would say all the things that you just mentioned are very good, telehealth, other health care services, but they're only good if people have access to them. And if we don't have primary care for all Vermonters, there's always going to be a chunk of people who don't have access to these important health care services.
No, it's absolutely true. But I think that, you know, when we talk about telehealth, for example, we can talk about it just in terms of broadband or how we look at our billing system, right? Constantly focusing on moving away from a fee-for-service to a population care base. And now we're providing care in different ways. So we have to take a step back and figure out what have we learned, what's going to stay beyond this pandemic, and how do we make sure that every Vermonter has access to universal quality health care in the state.
Let's start with Scott, who's calling from Island Pond. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking the call. And wanted to basically note, Bob, you sort of teed up the question that I had. They're in Vermont right now, post-COVID. There's a lot of money coming from the federal government through COVID relief, through a pending infrastructure program that's looking for problems to solve. And I was wondering if Ms. Gray could talk about, in particular, the tremendous challenges that we have in Vermont with broadband access, and whether these funds are sufficient and whether they are earmarked in a way that they could be used to provide the infrastructure necessary to expand broadband. And that's my question. Thanks.
Sure.
Lieutenant Governor, what do you think?
Yeah, thanks. Broadband is something I've campaigned on and care about deeply. And I think the opportunity is before us now to get this right, once and for all, so that Vermonters aren't waiting 10 years or 5 years or hopefully even 3 years for access to broadband. I think the work of the legislature through H360, I think it's $125 million that was allocated. I think that's an incredible amount. You know, it's extremely, extremely important. I think one area where I see further opportunity, and this will require support from our congressional delegation, is there a way to make sure that Vermonters have access now? And I'm not saying that access to fiber, you know, there's a lot of questions around what is the best technology, what is future-proof technology. I'm not saying that we should create a competition, but we really need to put people, those who do not have access in our state, at the center. And I just want to be clear, when we talk about broadband, we're talking about access to healthcare, as I just said. We're talking about access to education and online learning in some communities and some schools. It's here to stay in some form. We're talking about access to work, right? If we want Vermonters to be able to have remote work opportunities, or as we're welcoming lots of people to our state, and we want to encourage them to live in Island Pond or in Newbury, where I grew up, or in parts of the state where we still don't have access. We have to make investments. We have to make sure that the internet is affordable, that it's good internet, and that people have the hardware to get online. And so my only concern with H360 is that it's not, in my view, it may not be providing access soon enough, and that we may, with our next amount of money coming to the state want to invest in whatever tools are available to provide access to Vermonters right now. I mean, right now, broadband and internet is the highway for access to basic human rights in this country and in the state, and we have an opportunity to really make sure that we're closing the gap and we're closing it quick. It's a real equity issue.
You know, it seems like the state of Vermont has spent a lot of money on this issue already, and yet we don't have universal access to broadband. Just looking at it from the outside, it looks like there are these different competing groups and there's a power struggle going on about the technology of broadband, who's going to control it. What are your thoughts about that? Is there some hope that everyone's going to get on the same page here?
Well, technology is moving really quickly, right? There's satellites going up often. You know, there's satellites over Vermont, right? Starlink is an option for some Vermonters. Vermonters are purchasing Starlink. There are cell towers. We obviously are investing in fiber cables and our communication union districts, which are accountable, local, nonprofit solutions, and we should be very, very proud of that. My concern, and this is what I hear from Vermonters every single day, and in particular in the last two or three weeks as I've been out of the building, out in the state, I was down in Weston, where communities are saying, we can't wait. We simply can't wait because of how quickly the services and the needs of Vermonters are moving to a digital space. So my hope is that we try not to let the conflict between the technology or the conflict between who provides dictate the decision-making, but we as a state recognize that it is our responsibility to close this gap community by community, family by family, business by business, residence by residence, and doing our part to identify the need and to meet it as soon as possible.
I was going to ask you this more technical question, and I'm not a technical person, so this is dangerous for me to go down this road. But it seems to me that there are some short-term solutions, as you mentioned, with satellites, that might be good for the next 3 to 5 years that would give people immediate access to the internet. At the same time, there are folks who say that's not really the way to go. There's a technology that is going to be long-term and much better, and we should wait for that. Where are you on that spectrum of, do we provide access now, but it may not be the futuristic access that we want 5 years from now?
I don't. Right now, what I hear from Vermonters is that they don't want to wait. They want it now, and rightfully so. We need it. We need, every Vermonter needs to have access in some capacity. And so I don't think it's an either or. I think it's identifying the state saying, we should say, where is the need, and then who's going to meet it immediately, and then looking at the long-term build-out, where there is enough money to look at fiber for Vermont. But Vermonters can't wait 10 years or 5 years for that to happen.
Let's talk to Ben in Dorset. Hey, Ben, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'd like to ask the Lieutenant Governor what's going on with the ARPA money coming to Vermont. I mean, the previous caller mentioned it a little bit, but my understanding is that $1.25 billion has been allocated to Vermont, and $250 million of that is supposed to flow directly to local government, municipalities, and county government, and the $1 billion is under the control of the legislature. So, sorry to be so windy, but two questions. One, how much of the $1 billion have you discussed allocating specifically to local water systems? I know that is a priority of Governor Scott. He's mentioned that several times when the COVID stimulus money was first being discussed on some of his press conferences. Second question, my understanding is that half of the $250 million that was destined to local government is now under control of the legislature because we essentially don't have any county government. What's the status of that money?
Great. Thank you, Ben. Thanks so much for calling in. And I just wanted to reflect some of the data. you know, we have $207 billion, that's my understanding, coming from Vermont, in large part because of the hard work of Senator Leahy and our congressional delegation. It's really gone to bat for our small state through the small state minimum. And then the legislature has allocated about $600 million. And so there's a lot of money left to figure out in terms of spending and priorities. I think one challenge, and you put your finger on it, is how money was allocated to counties rather than towns. Right here in Vermont, we have municipal spending. We don't have a county structure to spend money other than our court system, which isn't the structure, isn't the body. So I know that's being ironed out. But I think the biggest thing is that right now we have an opportunity to assess our needs, to get around the state, which is what I'm doing all summer long, listening to Vermonters, meeting with communities, trying to figure out how we're going to spend this money so that we set ourselves up for a stronger recovery. I think part of that is childcare. I think part of that is identifying and closing the broadband gap. I think a huge part of that is addressing our housing crisis. But we also have a lot of structures that haven't received structures and infrastructure, rather, that have not received significant investment. Our school systems, our schools haven't received investment in more than a decade. We see that in our air quality systems, our water systems. I think you really put the nail on the head there. There's a lot that we, as a small state, that we don't have a big budget. We have a declining population. We have a demographic crisis. Our budget isn't one that allows for a lot of strategic investments like the ones that we can make now through the American Rescue Plan. But I see my role as getting out, meeting with you, getting down to Dorset, talking to community leaders, talking to nonprofits, talking to businesses, and then at the end of the summer, making recommendations to the legislature, to the governor, as an extra set of eyes and ears, so we make sure we get this right.
Ben, thanks for your phone call. I just had a follow-up question with broadband. You mentioned access. And also, when we were talking about healthcare, great developments in the healthcare system, but if you don't have access to the system, it doesn't mean a whole lot to you. When we talk about access to broadband, there are a lot of Vermonters, even when this service is available, simply are not going to be able to afford it. And you talked about affordable and in high-tech broadband. How do you make sure that these services remain affordable? Is that a state regulation that needs to go into place?
I think so. I think so, Bob. I mean, if we really think about the cost of Comcast every month, right, all the ways that we're chopping up the paycheck, but Comcast and Verizon phone bills, it's one thing to say, oh, we have access, that there is the service available. It's another to say that we can actually afford it. So I think it's incumbent upon the state to make sure that every Vermonter who can get online and can do so affordably. I was talking to the policymakers in Massachusetts. I'm on the Council of State Governments on a broadband and workforce development task force nationally, which is really exciting because I'm hearing, learning, sharing some of our ideas from Vermont. But one thing that Massachusetts did was they actually put they worked with different cell phone providers to remove the cap on data, which if we had done that here in Vermont for a lot of families over the last year, I think that could have made a big difference. So I think there's some things we can do, and I certainly would like to explore that with the legislature next year. Affordability is a big component.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Frick, who is calling from Brattleboro. Hi, Frick. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You just started to address one of my main concerns, and I noticed in dealing with various departments of the state of Vermont, they have been trying to push us to do everything online and not offer a paper option. And I would strongly urge you to advocate for a paper option no matter what's happening, because otherwise it's effectively, as you say, there's an affordability issue. It's kind of like a tax on Vermonters. The other part is there's sort of a steep learning curve for some people, especially older people who didn't grow up with computers. So that's another reason for that. But the housing thing is really what I want to ask you a question about. I think that you described a housing crisis and a demographic drop in population. If you put those two together, I think you will discover that the problem with housing is not the number of units, but whether people are willing to put them up for rent. This has become a more and more unfriendly state, and Brattleboro especially as a town, to actually risk renting out space, especially for people who are not professional landlords.
Okay.
I'm advocating for full funding for Section 8 as a way to address the financial end of that, but we also have a legislative regulatory problem that's adversely affecting housing.
Okay, Frick, let's see if we can get a comment from Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray. What about Frick's concerns about affordable housing? I know there's a tremendous amount of money in the budget for affordable housing, but that's going to take some years for all that construction to take place.
Yeah, Frick, thank you so much for calling in. And I actually wanted to just briefly address what you said about keeping the paper option. I think there was a really big push during the pandemic, as you know, to move everything online, right? So you could file claims online, access support services or benefits online, but that only works if you can get online. So that's another one of our lessons learned, right? We need to make sure that we keep all services and access to support available for all Vermonters as we go through this transition. So thanks for bringing that up. On housing, I just want to go back to the demographic crisis for a moment. What I mean by that is Vermont, as you probably know, is one of the oldest. I think maybe we're the second oldest state in the nation. We have a declining population, a shrinking workforce, and so our housing needs also change with that, right? We have a lot of Vermonters that need secure, accessible housing, and there's some places in the state, Orange County, where I grew up, or parts of the kingdom, where there's a lot of housing stock, but it isn't accessible. It isn't necessarily safe, and so there's a lot of retrofitting and weatherizing that needs to happen. But down in Brattleboro, as I've heard, or up in Chittenden County or in Rutland, there simply isn't enough housing. And while there are local efforts like the Putnam Block, or I know that there's been some really great programs in Brattleboro, there isn't enough. So I think this is a situation where having that needs assessment and making sure that we're investing in Orange County one way, we're investing in Windham County a different way, in Chittenden County. In some places, it may be building up and not out. In other cases, it may be, as I said, renovating or retrofitting. But we can't welcome people to the state. We can't grow our population if we simply do not have enough affordable, good quality, safe, and accessible housing.
Lieutenant Governor, last week we learned that Governor Scott vetoed a housing bill. Now, there were some things in that bill that he said he liked, including grants to fix up affordable housing units and also loans to encourage first home buying experiences for folks. But it also included a statewide registry for apartments, and it created some universal safety standards that would be required in each unit. As I say, the governor vetoed it because he said it's putting too much regulation in housing and would discourage what he referred to as mom and pop apartment dwellings from being rented out. Was the governor wrong to veto that bill?
You know, the governor, I've talked about that bill, and we talk regularly, and you know, we don't see eye to eye on everything. This is one area where I do think we need to have regulation in access to housing. We have so much housing need. This really is a situation where our landlords have a really big hand in the market. They have a lot of control. They have a lot of ability to rent to whomever they want, right? It's a landlord's market, as I said. So I think to have a body that is well structured, where we have they have enough staff, I know that was an issue for the governor, is important. Maybe this bill wasn't the right bill. I'm not going to speak to that specifically, but I do think we need to have a regulatory body in place. But more importantly, right now, we just need to address the accessibility gaps, making those really strategic investments so that we can meet the immediate needs of Vermonters. And then as we work to grow our workforce and welcome new people to the state, that we have the capacity to do so.
So did you support this bill?
Well, as the lieutenant governor, I definitely presided over the Senate, but a tie-breaking vote wasn't needed.
I guess I'm just trying to get a sense if that's the sort of approach that you think that state government should be taking.
I do think it's the approach. I do think that the not having enough people, as I understand one of the issues around S-79, was that do we have enough people to provide, to oversee that registry? And I think the registry is the direction we need to go with time. We didn't even have enough data during this pandemic to know who was renting and who's not, right? That impacts our ability to allocate funding, to get information out to renters. And this is a landlord's market, as I said. We have a lot of anybody who wants to rent right now can find someone to rent their property. And so making sure that that property is safe, that it's accessible, that it meets certain standards, I don't think it's too much to ask. So, yeah, I support the bill, but as the lieutenant governor, I want to be clear that my role is, you know, presiding over the Senate, and there wasn't a tie-breaking vote situation, but I would have supported it.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Joanna, who is calling from Burlington. Hi, Joanna. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I actually have a question about pensions. Thank you for taking my call. So my concern is, given the demographic and housing challenges that you've just outlined in bringing young people to the state, I have a lot of concerns about pensions. As a mid-career teacher in Burlington, I'm curious how you will go about continuing to make sure that we have an influx of qualified teachers during a year in which we've had tremendous staffing shortages. And due to those staffing shortages, compounding those staffing shortages, of course, are the demographic and housing questions that you just outlined. And what I'm wondering is, what are you doing for people like myself who are young enough to consider a career change if the pension concerns are not resolved? I think we're going to see tremendous numbers of young teachers who have been paying into the system, leaving a system that has even more open positions and a hard time filling them for our children in our state.
Joanna, that's a great question, a question on a lot of people's minds. There was a proposal in the House that came out and was alive for about a week. That proposal asked employees to work longer before they retired, to pay more into the system, and to receive fewer benefits. Lieutenant Governor Gray, at that time, you said that that proposal represented a broken commitment to our teachers and employees made at the time of hiring. We've got a summer study group meeting today, in fact, on this. It's a huge issue for the legislature. In talking to Joanna, what will you tell her about the approach that needs to be taken and whether or not what kind of sacrifices anybody, including the state, needs to make?
Well, first of all, I thank Joanna for the call and also for her service as a teacher, and just to recognize all of the teachers across the state who have gone above and beyond in the most challenging of circumstances, moving classrooms online, trying to connect with kids in any way possible to keep education accessible. And my heart goes out to our educators. We've asked them to do so much. But I want to speak specifically to the caller's question, and that is, with our demographic crisis, right now you can pick nearly any industry, nurses, educators, electricians, even restaurant workers, and we have a massive recruitment and retention challenge. We have a workforce shortage. So we come back to teachers, and teachers who get up every day ready to serve community, ready to serve our next generation. I'll add our state employees in as well, you know, the 9,000 people who serve as corrections officers or law enforcement officials or judges who are working in state government across the state and in Montpelier. This represents a large portion of our workforce, people that care about service. And our teachers, and 75% our women, are also in many cases looking to find childcare, trying to pay off student loan debt. So to say that we are now going to put retirement in question is deeply concerning, right? And it's not our teachers' fault that we ended up here. It's not the fault of state employees that we ended up here. What happened in Vermont was that we weren't seeing the return on investment that we probably needed to see. There was a sort of a kicking the can down the road long before I was in office. You know, there was concerns about unfunded pension liability, and now here we are. So it is a huge challenge, and I don't think that the initial proposal came out was a fair one. What I do feel is fair is what is happening now. You know, one, we've looked at the Vermont Pension Investment Committee, the VPIC. We've made some adjustments to make sure, I hope, that we see a better return on investment. You know, there's going to be more transparency, and hopefully our actuarial assumptions will be correct moving forward. And then having this summer task force, that, you know, there's a number of legislators who have stepped forward who are working extremely hard right now to do an analysis of where we at, and then we'll be making proposals going into the fall and going into the legislative session. So I think we're on the right track, but we need to have humanity in the process. We need to honor our commitments and recognize that we're state employees, right? At the end of the day, the governor is an employer, the attorney general is an employer, I'm an employer, the legislature employer. We're talking about people who get up every day to serve the state, and we want to make sure that they can retire and stay in Vermont and live with dignity.
So following up on Joanna's question, do you think just philosophically, as this summer study group looks at this and makes recommendations for lawmakers to consider during the 2022 session, do you think that if you're an existing teacher or an existing state employee, that you should be exempt from any of the changes that are then going to be put into place?
I think that's the hope. But if it's a question of, is there no retirement or retirement that's fair, retirement that's adequate, I think we would prefer the latter, right? And what the challenge, I think, was with the original proposal, anyone who was 5 years from retirement was kind of grandfathered in, but anyone else was not. And that creates a lot of disruption. We have a moment now to step back, to look at our funding. We have a lot of funding coming into Vermont. I think we know in some cases where we can't use the American Rescue Plan Act, but there may be other funding sources. You know, we can look at our budget. I think there's a way to get this right and to do it in a way that's fair, to make sure the state and employers are contributing an equal amount, and to make sure that doesn't have an undue impact on women or on families who are getting up every day, as I said, and working hard to serve the state and making sure that they can live in Vermont and retire in Vermont. I think that's incredibly important.
Lieutenant Governor, right at the beginning of the newscast before the program, it was reported that you'd raised almost $50,000 in the first 6 months of this year, an unusually large amount of money for the beginning of a first term for a statewide candidate. In comparison, Governor Scott has raised about $2,500, Treasurer Beth Pierce $50. Auditor Doug Hoffer and Secretary of State Jim Condos have not reported any fundraising. You've also hired a campaign staff person, which is somewhat unusual. Do you see how these developments could cause some people to think that you're in full campaign mode all the time?
You know, Bob, I think the unfortunate fact, and it's been kind of an eye-opening lesson learned experience for me, is that entering political life means you have to raise money. You know, it's not something. It's fun, but the last election, I ran against a millionaire who self-funded his campaign, who welcomed out-of-state special interest money into Vermont, and it's an incredible honor to serve as lieutenant governor. You know, and I get up every day, and I get to come to the state house, and I get to talk to Vermonters, and I don't take any of that for granted. So, you know, I'll share. I'm really honest about it. You know, I have student loan debt. I don't own a home. I'm not a millionaire. So I've raised just enough money to hire a great Vermonter, a young Vermonter who's excited about politics, to manage political activity so I can focus on my job and being lieutenant governor every day.
Do you see how that could create the impression that it's taking sort of politics in the office to a new level?
Yeah, I guess I could see that, but I see it more as being really transparent, right? That there's someone separate who's doing some political activity, be it talking to the Democratic Party, so that I can come to work every day and do my job, and creating a clear line between the two and being really transparent about it.
Now, lawmakers are prohibited from raising money during the legislative session because of potential conflicts of interest. Should those same rules apply to you as lieutenant governor?
You know, I haven't thought about that too much. You know, I see my role as one that's pretty unique. You know, I work closely with the governor, making sure that we're focusing on vaccinations and relief efforts, but also presiding over the Senate. You know, as I said, it's an unfortunate fact about entering political life, you know, that you have to raise a little bit of money. And I don't, you know, I don't have the privilege of having money of my own. And I think it's a real testament to those Vermonters who support the campaign and recognize that challenge. And it's chipped in to make sure that we can have a separate operation so that I can do my job as lieutenant governor every day.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Tim in Waterville. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me on. A two-part question for the lieutenant governor. Vermont receives from the federal government second chance funding to help assist people who are incarcerated with getting out and really establishing themselves. Do you feel that we're using that money from the Second Chance Act appropriately, number one? And number two, how do you feel about the idea of offering college programming to people who are incarcerated?
Thank you for the call and thank you for the question. I think I'll kind of take a step back and reflect generally on the importance of making sure that there's good quality reintegration programs here in Vermont, making sure that individuals who are coming out of prison, right? I served as an assistant attorney general previously, and I think the best success stories that we hear are about individuals coming out of our correctional facilities, getting into transitional housing, getting the support that they need. The last thing that we want to happen here in the state is to have individuals going back into the prison system. It's extremely costly, and especially when people are going back in because of an issue related to probation or parole on those technical requirements that we should be able to provide support for, right? Housing, employment. So I think that's incredibly important. And then offering college credit, or training, I think that's a great option, making sure that we're allowing Vermonters the opportunity to get out and to succeed. So I hope that answers your question, but always happy, and I'll say this, I'm always happy to talk, to listen, and you can contact my office. You can go to lieutenantgovernor.ltgov.vermont.gov or call me directly, and would love to hear your thoughts.
Just following up on Tim's question, there are some people in the legislature who would like to build a new prison in Vermont. There are others who think that that's an awful lot of money being spent that could be spent better in rehabilitation services. What are your thoughts about that?
My concern, this was something I raised over the last year and have raised at the beginning of this legislative session with some of our congressional leaders and the governor, is that we still have a population of Vermonters that is out of state. And we continue to contract with one of the largest private prison companies in the country to house Vermont prisoners. I don't think that is the best way to keep family links restored. I don't think that's the best way to ensure that there is rehabilitation and community reentry programs, which are extremely important. So I would support bringing those prisoners home. I think that there's a lot of lessons learned from the pandemic. We've been able to decrease our prison population. And if we can do that through the existing space that we have, through some of the investments that we've made in criminal justice reform, that would be an incredible outcome.
Let's get a quick call in from James in Middlebury. Hi, James. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Lieutenant Governor, Vermont has been trying for about 75 years to clean up the lake, but has failed to do so roughly because it refuses to effectively regulate the dairy industry. But now with the Global Warming Solutions Act, the state has obligated itself to reduce pollution from dairy in the atmosphere, which I guess would help it also reduce pollution in the lake. Do you have a new approach for how the state is going to do that?
James, thanks so much for the call. Yes, and we've talked a lot over the last several months about broadband, about childcare, about a lot of the critical infrastructure around this pandemic and response. We haven't been talking as much about climate change, right? But we've seen it. Our maple sugar has had a really, really tough season this year. We've seen record high temperatures across Vermont. We see droughts across Vermont. Anyone that's trying to keep a garden alive knows that. So I do think we need to now say the other crisis is the climate crisis, that it is real, that we need to trust the science in the same way that we trusted the science around our incredible response here in Vermont to the pandemic, and make sure that we're doing everything we can to keep the lake clean, keep our forests and our fields alive and going, make sure our air is clean, and doing everything we can to protect our land environment. And I think the Climate Council is headed in the right direction. I know there's a lot of work, but there's a lot of important voices at the table, and I'm confident they can get it right.
As part of the recommendations from that Climate Change Council, do you think that lawmakers should look at enacting a tax to discourage carbon use?
I hope that's not the direction we end up going, that we can put a lot of incentives in place. And I think that's the better route to go. But I really leave it to them to figure out what is best for Vermont, to making sure that we're bringing more people to the table, that we're coming up with programs and solutions that ensure those who work our lands can continue to do so, that there's equity in whatever regulations we put in place so that everyone can participate. Now, I appreciated the governor talking about the new F-150 the other day, right? We all need to be looking to the future, to things that we can do in our daily lives to make sure that we can all participate in protecting the land and environment for the next generation and meeting our climate goals, which are real and significant.
And with transportation being such a large part of Vermont's carbon footprint, do you think the state should be doing more to encourage the purchase of electric vehicles?
I do. I hope that I certainly hope to be able to purchase one in the future. Right now, I think there is a pretty big affordability question. But as we see more electric vehicle charging stations coming up around the state, we see more dealerships being able to service electric vehicles, which is important. There was some good work in the legislature in that front this year. So I think that's the direction we certainly need to go. But, you know, my brothers will tell me, you know, right now, what can I pull with a Prius? And they work on the farm, right? So we need to make sure that those who are working our lands or working outside have the vehicles they need to do their work and that are EV. So.
Well, this has been an important discussion about many of the key issues facing the state of Vermont. Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray, many thanks for taking the time to be on the program today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob. And I just want to thank you and thank all the listeners and just make sure that folks know I'm going to be around the state. I'd love to come visit you. We are listening to Vermonters. You can go to ltgov.vermont.gov to participate in our Recover Stronger tour. Now's the time to put Vermonters at the forefront. Now, in the summer, I'll be doing just that. So thanks for having me.